Good afternoon, everyone. Welcome to Open Source School of Thought, CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus and Community Radio. I'm Adam A. Donaldson of Guelph Politico, and joining me is...
Scotty Hertz, determined to insert himself to every conversation that we have over the next hour.
Oblique reference.
Because I pretty much have to, right?
It's not like you're the daughter of the president and are highly unqualified for anything. You can just, like, walk into the family photo of the G20 and nobody cares.
I guess we're talking about that later.
Yeah. All right.
A little bit of a heads up for
a little
folks.
Bit of a spoiler alert. Yeah, yeah. Open Source is CFRU's political and current affairs discussion show, and you can find us here every Thursday at 5 p.m. where we talk about the latest news items from Guelph, Ontario, Canada, and around the world, and sometimes interview local newsmakers and politicians. This week, though, we are just going to be talking about the news, including Hong Kong. The protest is strong with the people of the former British colony, but what's driving all this civil disobedience and how long can it last? And then pretty much that's how he sees himself.
The good ship, U.S. Donald.
Celebrating the 4th of July with military parade he's always wanted, even while he's threatening to be rained out, and actually is presently being rained out.
It's looking pretty bad.
And meanwhile, there's 3,000 controversies going on, so what mess is America this week? And then finally, the Supreme Court of Canada has ruled that judges need to be more sensitive about allowing past sexual history as evidence in assault cases. But why are we surprised that this is being ruled on again? But first, if there's one thing more dangerous than Donald Trump, it's cartooning about Donald Trump. And certainly one cartoonist knows that better than any of us. It's been kind of an ongoing controversy all week. Michael DeArt of the Brunswick News chain, which is owned by the Irving family, he says he was let go of his contract. He was a freelance cartoonist after a cartoon he made of Donald Trump went viral. And we wanted to bring in a cartooning expert. And Scotty and I are not a cartooning expert.
Fans. We're fans.
We are fans. But to help us shed some light from the artist's perspective, we are joined on the line by Gareth Lind, who is a graphic designer and cartoonist who has been published in iWeekly, This Magazine, Alternatives Journal, and Yahoo, and is still well famous, I think, for the old Welsh Mertz strip. So, Gareth, thanks for joining us today.
Hi, Scotty. Hi, Adam. How are you doing?
I think we're well. I think we're interested in talking about cartooning. So, Gareth, you are no stranger to courting political controversy in your strip. What was your first thoughts when you heard about what happened to Mr. DeArt?
It's actually Datter, just as a correction. But
fair enough.
My first thoughts were, I mean, I guess I'm not tremendously surprised, but it struck me as odd that he was being his contract was he was essentially being fired for cartoons he didn't even do for the paper. So it's kind of a new wrinkle in that what you do outside of the paper influences the paper's reputation and therefore influences your fate as a cartoonist. So the cartoon he did in question, just to recap, was of Donald Trump playing golf beside two dead migrants who had drowned, based on the famous photograph that had gone viral as well. So this cartoon went viral on its own, and he had drawn that as a social media presence, and it was retweeted by the likes of George Takei and Mark Hamill from Star Wars, and so it certainly had legs, and very shortly thereafter, he was let go.
Mm-hmm. You had a question.
Yeah, I did. This is the kind of thing. Do you think have we ever really seen in Canada at least this level of attention being paid to editorial and political cartoons? You know, we've got the example in France of like Charlie Hebdo, which is not in the news for other reasons, but there it's pretty cutting stuff. And I think a lot of us think of kind of Canadian editorial political cartoons as a bit more gentle and kind of funny, but these particular cartoons are really hitting some heavy notes comparatively, I think. But
well, historically, Canadian cartoons have actually been fairly hard hitting in the 70s and 80s, earlier as well during the Vietnam War and when Trudeau was in power with the October Crisis. There's been some pretty heavy duty cartoons. There's a famous one. I'm not sure if it was actually. I think it was a Canadian cartoonist had Idi Amin, the Ugandan dictator, eating a child.
That's actually my earliest memory, by the way, that cartoon. I remember seeing that in the paper, and I was really young, and that definitely left an impression. But
yeah, and then there's the famous one in which a cartoonist was actually sued out west. I forget the politician in question, but it was a BC premier was shown. I'm not sure exactly what the events leading up to it were, but he was picking the legs off a fly. And it had some sort of relevance to what was happening then, and the cartoonist was sued. I don't believe the premier won. But so there is a tradition in Canada of hard-hitting cartoons, but it's been of late that they've become somewhat stale and a little like Muzak, as Ted Rall, who's an American independent cartoonist, called it. We used to have fangs, and the editors have kind of defanged us, and those who have fangs no longer have jobs.
So is that it? Then this kind of softening of it is coming from editorial influence and from above, like from people that, you know, generally used to own the media but weren't necessarily involved and kind of let certain things go, well, and now it's like that influence is becoming so strong that we see incidences like this where it's kind of dumbed down and shoved out of the way.
There's so many factors involved. It's not just that. It's not just the power of advertisers. I mean, in a way, cartoonists are like many creatives suffering from the rise of the internet and not having a viable business model. So we're not alone in this struggle, but the fact that cartoonists do make political commentary does mean that we're ripe to be axed first. In the States, with 10 times the population, there are 30 full-time cartoonists or less, political cartoonists. In Canada, there are 10 to 15, I believe. So that gives you the sense. In the States, it's actually worse, and there's been many documented cases where when an editor or a publisher has to make cuts, it's usually the cartoonist who gets the boot right away, and in part because they've been not allowed to actually do their job, which is to poke fun at people in power and other issues and actually engage readers in that way. And oddly enough, satire is still popular, still really, really strong, and it's a very visual medium, as exemplified by TV and late night TV and talk shows, et cetera, where actually most of what you see in what the popular shows are satire. So it's kind of odd that editors have chosen not to foster this satirical medium. And in fact, I mean, it's nearly dead. I mean, no one who wants to, there are no young people who want to become cartoonists these days because there's no money in it and no recognition.
Right. And this is an unusual case too, because Michael talked a lot about how he wasn't even submitting Trump cartoons to the New Brunswick news anymore. He wasn't even submitting cartoons about, he says Andrew Scheer or the current premier of New Brunswick, Blaine Hayes, because of, you know, that editorial slant. The Irvings own the papers in New Brunswick. They have business interests that involve these people, so it's in their business interest to sort of keep that relationship and not let their newspapers present a counter narrative that might suggest that they're against the politicians they need.
Yeah, it's kind of, I mean, there's always been corporations owning media. It's not exactly new.
No.
But but it seems to be that the corporate control over culture has become so dominant that that they can get away with more now, and that I'm surprised they haven't even justified their decision, aside from saying it had nothing to that they had thought about it a long time ago, and who they're hiring is Greg Perry to replace Michael Dadder, who is a safer cartoonist, and he has a widespread syndicate which goes all over the place, so he sells his cartoons for much cheaper.
But there's actually some breaking news on that. Greg Perry's quit.
Yeah.
Oh, really?
Just found this out before airtime. Okay. And his comment was...
I was going to ask.
Yeah. So he's ending up kind of in the middle of this hubbub, and Dieter didn't really wish it on him either, but he said, you know, it's all this over a job that pays the same per month as a grocery chain. So that kind of speaks to what you mentioned, Gareth, about the fact that, you know, there's so few now, and it's not exactly a... You know, no one's really making a living at this now compared to... The golden days, I guess, of
Well, yeah, I mean, the last paid like regular paying gig I had was for Yahoo.ca, and that was like 5 years ago. And there was a pretty enlightened editor who wanted to do a cartoon every day and actually make a good online presence and try to replicate what newspapers were doing. So I had a slot every week, and I mean, I was paid what I made when I got started in the late 80s. So that just gives you an idea. And of course, you know, it was, I mean, I can tell you what it was. It was $50. So, you know, and the cartoon takes, 6 or 8 hours, right? So you can do the math on that one. So, I mean, I mean, a lot of artists are starving, though. So I feel like I don't want to just sort of be like when you asked me to come on the show, I said, well, it's the same old story, starving artist, right? but this is a viable medium, which it's a commercial medium, more so than traditional arts, and it does sell papers. Like, people do like cartoons, I believe, anyway.
Greg Perry also mentioned when he said he was not accepting the position, that he'd sort of been facing some kind of harassment from people, that he took the job, and people right. Like people seem to be reacting like he stole the job of the cartoonist. And I was wondering, what's your reaction to that? Because, I mean, as you said, this is a job. And, this may be part of the fault of the Irving's press machine, too, that, they were going in a new direction, and they called Greg Perry a fan favorite artist. So they may have set him up to become the vestibule of online hatred. But it seems like he's taken been taken for a rough ride for just being a starving artist, as you said.
Yeah. I'm not sure actually where Perry's from. I don't know if you know, cause I don't follow his work that well, but I respect him for not taking it on. I guess there is, I would imagine there'd be a lot of pressure because his name was mentioned. Right. But I think it's high time that cartoonists stood together. I'm a member of the Association of Canadian Editorial or Cartoonists, which is a small motley crew, and we try to stay together as much as possible. And it's so, I mean, it'd be interesting to see what the New Brunswick chain does, whether or not they find a cartoonist to replace him, and then maybe figure no one really cares and just go ahead with it. I would love to see some blowback.
Well, it sounds like Perry worked for them like a few years ago, and then he was let go. But this was him getting called back. So,
oh, I see.
But I guess he seems to be based on the East Coast. He has a very brief entry in the Canadian Animation, Cartooning, and Illustration Encyclopedia online here.
Okay, so he is from the East Coast. I know he does syndicate nationally and to the States, and I think he runs a syndicate of some kind as well.
Yeah, it just seems like he took a job and the roof fell on him.
I sympathize with him, but I certainly I'm not speaking for myself. I wouldn't take it on, not that I would have the opportunity to do so.
Right. So, I mean, looking to the future, is there, no news is bad news or however you want to put it, but I mean, does this kind of maybe reawaken the art form a bit, that maybe we've proved and through this cartoon in particular that editorial cartoons still hold an important place in the media discussion?
Well, yeah, I mean, there's a great Beaverton piece on how they were axing the one cartoon that actually makes print relevant, right?
Yeah.
So it's fairly, I think it's a good lesson. And of course, this always happens. If something is banned, the people who are banning it will get far more exposure, like what is being banned will get far more exposure than otherwise. So, if they hadn't have acted, this would be just another, it would have gone viral, but it would have been just another viral cartoon. And then, tomorrow there would be another viral cartoon or another viral meme. So by banning it, they've actually given it legs. And I think I'm happy that there's been so much press about this because it's a huge issue. And it'd be great if people realized the value of cartoons.
Yeah, because it sounds like the Star has picked up Deatter as well. So, his market has obviously increased a bit.
Considering he's running it's one of the last Star sometimes anyway, but I wouldn't be surprised if he gets
I think he's
full-time gig.
Yeah.
Well, that's great. That's great.
Well, Gareth Lynn, thank you so much for your time and your expertise, and we'll try and chat with you again.
Okay, take care.
Thanks. Thank
you. Thanks, Gareth. Once again, that was Gareth Lind, a local graphic designer and cartoonist and sometimes political cartoonist. I just want to add, too, that, you know, you and I, Scotty, were at the thing at the museum last week about local media and how everyone is missing newspapers, apparently. And
everybody in the room was missing newspapers.
And, you know, like, this is, I mean, and people are, like, iffy about the internet stuff, and it's like, I think you should still be iffy about newspapers, like, especially when they're owned by the Irvings.
Oh, yeah.
The Irvings are the sixth largest landholder in the United States. The sixth largest landowner. So, you know, they're not publishing stuff about the and New Brunswick government because the premier of New Brunswick is a former Irving executive.
Mm-hmm.
They have huge business interests. They pay $100 per hectare in business in property taxes for their lumber yards in New Brunswick. So, you know what? I get not trusting stuff on the internet, but there's you can't really trust your newspapers either sometimes.
Yeah. And, I mean, and no one owns us, so feel free to support us
yeah.
and the Ontarian and local media such as that, because it's very necessary. And we are under massive threat as well. But again, a topic for another day. I think we're going to do a one-hour special on that.
Who's threatening
one us? Of these days.
It's going to be a
Stop
telethon.
Threatening me, yes.
Speaking of threat, we're going to go over to Hong Kong. Which has been the subject of a lot of protest lately, a lot of pro-democracy protests. Hong Kong is pretty much the only place in China you can have a right to assemble and a right to protest the government. In this case, it's over a new law that will make it possible for people in Hong Kong to be extradited to the Chinese mainland for trial. The Chinese government say it's because they don't want criminals to go to Hong Kong and feel like it is a safe haven for them. People in Hong Kong are understandably worried that it's going to mean that instead of facing more Western-style justice in Hong Kong, they will be sent to the Chinese mainland where trials are, shall we say, more cut and dry in favor of the prosecution.
Yes, and that's one of the problems is that people who are activists and involved anything from street marches to beyond that are concerned that this is going to be used as punitive measures on those people. Now, what's amazing about these the marches, averaging about 1 million, and supposedly the one on Sunday where the parliament was taken over,
mm-hmm.
which has caused the current sort of it hasn't caused a certain issue, but it's kind of probably going to bring things to a head.
Yeah, accelerated.
Accelerated everything. 2 million people, supposedly. 30% of the population out in the streets. Like, try and get that anywhere in Canada, let alone, okay, maybe for the Raptors. We get for the Raptors in Hong Kong. It's like, our rights are threatened.
When the Raptors win, you can get 2 million people in the streets.
Get the umbrellas out. Now, it's pretty amazing to me that there hasn't been a crackdown. I know we're probably, I'm not saying there should be, but the days of the Tiananmen level of response
mm-hmm.
is over. Probably a lot of that is to do with social media and the fact that the Chinese government can't control it. And that Hong Kong is supposed to be the one country, two systems, where it's like, okay, we're going to let you protest. But there is going to be a limit to it. And the fear is, I think, is in the back of people's minds, like, okay, what is the crackdown going to be? It might not necessarily be cracking heads, but you can bet that they're going to go after anybody that's remotely identified with this, anybody that they can.
Well, they've already arrested people.
Yeah. And, well, are they going to be extradited to Beijing, though, is the question. Will special measures be put in place for that to happen? That's the unknown. I mean, they obviously can't deport or arrest 2 million people, but you never know. And also,
but they can arrest a dozen people. And then there were a dozen people arrested overnight here, but like sort of first thing in the morning in Hong Kong. And, it ranged from, possession of weapons, assaulting police officers, obstruction, unlawful assembly. And I mean, those are some pretty serious charges. And then there were people who were arrested yesterday, about a half a dozen people who were charged with basically making police officers targets by releasing like information like their cell phone numbers or home addresses online and saying, hey, like, here's where these cops who've done stuff live.
Doxing them, I guess.
Yeah. It's sort of. It's kind of a DDoX.
Reverse.
It's DDoX, an IRL DDoX.
Yeah.
But, yeah, so I these are kind of serious charges, so it wouldn't be surprising if this inadvertently ends up sort of being the test case for, you know, sending dissenters to mainland China to face trial. Because I think one of the interesting things this has opened up is a spotlight on Hong Kong, which, despite the fact it was returned to China in 1997, has been seen as sort of like this pool of Western style, like, democratic justice system. When I think the reality is, when you sort of get into it, you have a leadership in Hong Kong that is selected by Beijing. People, like 6% of the people who run Hong Kong are actually directly elected. Mm-hmm. And it also tests it because there's supposed to be this 50-year buffer from 1997 to 2047, where I guess Hong Kong basically gets used to the idea of being a part of China, to that two system, one nation dealy, where China wasn't supposed to, you know, mess around with the system. And here we are 22 years later, not even halfway there, and China's already sort of testing those limits by you know, trying to change this one aspect of the judicial system. So, you know, it's not surprising that people are sort of feel a bit riled, because this was, I think, not necessarily the worst case scenario for a lot of people, long timers in Hong Kong, about what Chinese rule would look like, but it's certainly not a positive circumstance.
No, and it's going to be incremental, I think, the changes in terms of toward, you know, they will progressively chip away at Hong Kong until, you know, Beijing probably does have complete control. One of the key demands of the protesters was that Carrie Lam, who is the, is she, she's not the governor. I was trying to, what is her title? Like,
she's the chief executive.
Chief executive, like it's a corporation.
Which already sounds like so, yes, like futuristic fascist. But
is, she's a, yeah, a career politician and handpicked by Beijing. That is how it works. It's like, okay, you and you. It's very, so it's not really democratic. The goal of most of the protesters, like, you know, complete and an absolute democracy seems to be one of the key words that keeps coming up, but it's not really, like, it's kind of like, well, if the chief executive is handpicked by, you know, the powers that be in Beijing, of course you're never really going to see what constitutes freedom. Something that was interesting too with the protesters that I noticed is that they were flying the old colonial flag, like the British flag, which I thought was right. Weird. It's difficult to kind of gauge where the protesters stand. I guess they stand on a wide range of political issues, but it's weird that, you know, you're sort of touting one colonial master over another. And if China, you know, right, if China says that they're not really the colonial masters of Hong Kong, you know, it's a really, you know, don't believe it.
It's bizarre because it's
really,
it's
weird.
Like,
yeah, so if you exchange one for the other, it's like, well, we want the old system.
It's like, yeah, like
we want the British back. Like, do you really want the British back?
Caught between like a rock and a hard place.
Yeah.
It's interesting that, and I found this, I think, on the BBC in an explainer, but like 15% of people in Hong Kong identify themselves as Chinese, and 3% of people between 18 and 29 identify themselves as Chinese. So it's like,
I thought you were going to say Jedi or something.
So it's like the new generation, like, recognizes themselves as Hong Kongers even more than people who remember living in a Hong Kong that was not under China's control.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I guess there's like some sort of groundswell for like independence for Hong Kong. You know, I'm not sure to what degree that's there, but what it does say is that there's a population who does not identify themselves as Chinese, that does not like identify themselves probably as like maybe British citizens, but like as Hong Kong, as this unique thing that is separate and apart from China.
Absolutely. And I think that's been a very long arc too, because growing up, our Chinese neighbors were actually from Hong Kong, saw this coming, I'm going to say more than 30 years ago. Mm-hmm. And they all, like,
well, the deal was made in 84.
Yeah. So and this would have even been before that, but people would refer to them as the you know, the Chinese people in the neighborhood, and they're always, always insistent that they were from Hong Kong. And of course, the way you're always able to tell is, like, you know, English first name, like proper English name, like Jeffrey. And I won't name the people on the air, but they're good folks, haven't seen them in a long time. So they were pretty adamant that they were not Chinese, even though by all, if you just, you met them, you would say, yes, absolutely, you're Chinese. But
right.
So it is, it's
by
it's,
appearances. Yeah.
It is by all accounts a separate country or a nation, or, and how they're going to define that, I don't know, but they're stuck. Like, it's not even like a Tibet arrangement where it was kind of invaded. This was like, well, we're handing this back over.
Yeah.
There's going to be this long process to give it back, and then at some point it won't be the one country, two system. It's just going to be,
and you can't ignore, like, the whole colonial aspect of, like, how Hong Kong came to be, and with, like, the Opium Wars and what Britain went in there and did.
Yeah,
it's just some of the ugliest of the colonial era,
as goes with colonialism. Yeah,
right. It's
everywhere.
It's just it's just bad. All over. The thing about the Parliament buildings, which I think you're right, is going to be sort of like the nail in the coffin for these, because certainly the Hong Kong authorities have made a big deal about letting the press in there. And, you know, it's kind of like when Iran shoots down a drone or something, and they have all
display
the Iranian
drone,
press
yeah.
and display all the stuff they found. And
it was an old drone, though.
It was anyway.
But, unmanned.
We'll get there.
Yeah.
But the with, like, going in there and showing all the graffiti and all the mess, and not touching on the fact, like, the protesters left money for all the soda they took. Or the fact that they left, like, the bookcases alone, and, like, the cultural artifacts alone.
It was just the symbols.
Yeah.
Particularly the Hong Kong symbol that...
Yeah, it was a direct response to the government and the symbols of government, not necessarily the culture and the people. And, you know, it's this kind of weird anarchic, but still, like,
very
civilized
message,
protest. Yeah. You know, like, yeah, they broke the glass on the front doors and spray painted some messages around.
Some money for the glass.
But they didn't steal the pop. They paid for the pop.
Oh, that's too funny. I didn't know that. That's like...
Yeah.
I don't know whether they'll be forgiven for that.
Well,
it's... Yeah. So this is a wait and see, because there's... I hate to say it, but there's something definitely going to come down the pipe. What it is, we don't know, but...
Yeah, I mean, again, this is, like, has been incremental. You know, China has been, you know, there were, like, booksellers who have been sort of put out of business in Hong Kong. You know, there's been journalists who have been barred from entry. You know, there's all sorts of things. A tycoon in Hong Kong, like, found himself on the Chinese mainland and put on trial. So it's, like, this isn't over, so... We're going to take a break and then come back with the rainy news from Washington. You're listening to Open Sources Guelph here on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus and Community Radio. Where they all promised on snapper jeans. You know that tilt-a-whirl down on the South Beach drag. I got on it last night and my shirt got caught. And it kept me spinning, bitch. Didn't think I'd ever get off. Ooh, Sandy, the world is rising behind us. This pier lights a carnival life on the water. Running left. Sandy on the 4th of July. We have a running sort of Springsteen gag here. Off yeah.
air, not on the air generally.
With respect.
Guess who that was?
With respect. What is
this? Just in. It's my new phone. I have no idea what I'm doing. I do know what I'm doing with vinyl, though, and that was Bruce Springsteen, the E Street Band from The Wild, The Innocent, and The E Street Shuffle, and the song was The 4th of July, Asbury Park, with Sandy, which is... going on today somewhere. I don't know about Asbury Park, what's happening. Maybe there's fireworks, but we know that there's fireworks in downtown Washington, D.C.
Well, there might not be fireworks. It's a torrential downpour in Washington right now.
So it was heat, so the tanks wreck the road, and then the fireworks.
All right, so it's been quite a week for U.S. President Donald Trump. Maybe we'll just like sort of play it by ear. We can't possibly cover all the scandals, but I mean, the big one that I think a lot of people have been talking about is that the military parade that was supposed to be taking place in Washington today, although I don't know what the status is of that. I was just looking at Twitter, and apparently his speech is still on for 6, although it might be delayed. That seems to be uncertain at best.
Tremendous rain. sent by Russians, Chinese, somebody.
But I almost feel like Scotty's phone is going to ruin this whole thing.
There's a robot in the studio.
This isn't the cantina. Anyway.
Yeah. I promise I'll work on that for next week, Chief. Anyway. I really will.
You know, there's so much going on with the migrants at the border and those deplorable conditions. And not only that, but the ProPublica reporting that there's this Facebook group that is made up of borders and customs officials, crap posting about, you know, people in detention and making fun of them. And then there was the tour with House Democratic members where it's alleged someone told one of the detainees when they asked for some water, told them to drink out of the toilet bowl. You know, it's a humanitarian nightmare down there, and it just keeps getting worse.
Yeah, Snuka, and it's, you know, especially with the way that policy is, you know, you would think that there would be somewhere on the border, knowing America, like either an empty military base or something where they could actually put people and give them their, you know, the necessities of life, let's say. But to see the footage that was taken when they were in there and hearing, I think it was AOC and some others were there.
Mm-hmm. She was there, yeah.
And mentioned the fact that people are drinking out of toilets and have like tinfoil blankets and stuff. This is ridiculous things when you think, okay, this is America, the great America. Mm-hmm. And this is how they're treating people at the border. But of course, I think a lot of that is being prompted by the policy from the top, and of course it's, you know, from Trump on down, where it's mm-hmm. like, well, we don't want these people, you know, we've talked endlessly about the narrative that's going on about the border and the wall, lots of wall, plenty of wall. I don't think there really is no easy fix. Well, there is an easy fix for this. They could actually take care of people and find a place for them, but
well, I mean, then that's,
and they're being overwhelmed to a degree. But
a lot of the kids in custody have relatives in the United States who would be ready and will. I think it's something like 90% of the kids in custody could go to someone in the United States and who could care for them and give them, you know, soap and a toothbrush and a meal that isn't a bologna sandwich. Or, you know, can get them the medications that they need. You know, this is another thing, is that, you know, there are doctors in these areas of these border facilities who are in charge of sort of going in and checking people's medical conditions, and they are overwhelmed. It's just a bureaucratic nightmare. It's the nightmare version of government that a lot of Republicans present. You know, government can't do anything. But, I mean, of course, this is a nightmare situation that is, yes, being driven by so many people trying to get across the border. A lot of them are people trying to escape violence or mm-hmm. other sort of social circumstances, and not necessarily the regular economic migrants that have been border crossers in the past. And a lot of them are families, and these border officials would probably be overwhelmed under the best of circumstances, but because anyone colored brown is sort of being rounded up and collected and put in one of these places, it's exacerbated the problem. And then the third piece of this is that it seems that there's a bureaucracy that doesn't care about how people are being treated.
Yeah.
And that they're callous and they're having these little secret Facebook groups where they mock people and degrade them.
Which adds an extra layer to the whole thing, because it is despicable, really, to hear that that's going on. And it's not new, and it's not news, but you know, when these types of things are unearthed, it's like, oh, I can't believe that's going on. You can't believe that's going on. They treat people coming across the border as if they're inhuman. You're going to have this kind of mentality. It's like, well, they're just garbage people coming from garbage countries. So
you mean asshole countries?
Yes. Or yeah, I was trying to be a bit more polite, but this is the narrative. And should we talk about the Eastern trip a little bit?
Oh yeah,
I think it's probably been all talked out of the media, but it's pretty like, incredible.
I mean, like Brian Stelter made the point on Reliable Sources last Sunday that you know if. It had been like a normal presidency, and the president goes to the G20 and jokes with Vladimir Putin about, like, oh, don't interfere in our election. Don't do it. Yuck, yuck, yuck. Isn't it great you don't have fake news in Russia? It's because you kill all the reporters. Yuck.
Oh, my goodness.
And then
he
has breakfast with Mohammed bin Salman like a week after the UN says, hey, you know, we should probably investigate how Mohammed bin Salman sent some guys into the Saudi embassy in Istanbul and hacked the guy to death. But Trump sits down and has breakfast with him. And then he proposes on Twitter, hey, Kim Jong-un, why don't we go hang out in the DMZ? And Kim Jong-un's like, sure, why not? What else do I have to do on a Sunday morning? And he does it. And in making history, as the first sitting president to enter North Korea, hands Kim Jong-un another public relations victory for him, which is what he wants. He wants to be seen as a world player. Trump just hands it to him and gets absolutely nothing in return. There is no further guarantee that North Korea is going to denuclearize or that they're going to stop their missile tests or that there's going to be like some sort of detente or some sort of move towards a permanent armistice with South Korea or that he's going to stop starving his people or that he's going to stop killing his relatives who might get in his way. Absolutely nothing. And I'm going to steal a line from John Lovett on Pod Save America. There was more groundwork that went into the detente between Taylor Swift and Katy Perry than went into this. And it's just, he keeps giving this away. And I don't know what it is. Like, is he like chasing this idea that he's going to get a Nobel Peace Prize for these like photo ops he keeps handing to Kim Jong-un? I don't know.
I honestly think it's just to create a video for the re-election. Like he's going to get a bit that he'll be able to use. I'm the first one that's ever done this. And it also kind of, you know, pads out the whole much was accomplished. And, you know, I've made history. I'm the only president that's ever done this. I'm the greatest in history. All of that stuff. I've gone where no other president's gone before. I think he likes Star Trek a little bit as well, but maybe not too socialist form or something. But, you know, there's that.
Oh, for sure.
That narrative is like, I'm the only one that has done all these things. And that's why you should reelect me in 2020. That's all it is. Because think about how much footage you can get out of that 2 minutes if you're kind of like, oh, I'm, you know, the great peacemaker. Yeah, but it's all showmanship.
He's accomplished literally nothing.
He has no foreign policy. But the policy, and you know, you'll read this on more than one channel, is just kind of like, it's this scattershot thing where it's just, it's chaos. It's Trump first and everything. There's no coherence to anything. He tweeted Pyongyang, probably knowing that they listened to everything. He says, yeah, okay, come on over.
Yeah.
And it was to orchestrate it too. It sounds like it was just.
Yeah, it was nothing. He was just like, hey, Kim Jong-un,
yeah.
You know, I'm in the neighborhood. Why don't I just pop by, you know, the old DMZ?
We would be very pleased if you come.
You know, we'll hang out and stuff. And like, that's how it was. It's handled it.
Didn't the new media person have to hip check some North Koreans out of the way?
They were trying to. Yeah, to her credit, she at least seems to care about press freedom slightly more than Sarah Huckabee Sanders did.
Yeah.
Still hasn't brought back the old press briefing yet. But, you know, I guess Sarah Huckabee Sanders was still technically on the job till Friday. But that's neither here nor there.
She didn't go on the trip.
She didn't go on the trip. I mean, because she was technically done by then.
Mm-hmm.
She's going to Arkansas and run for governor, apparently. That's what Trump said. But, you know, who can believe him?
She should be the best governor.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah. It's just not even to the impersonation. It's just so easy to do Trump now because you know exactly where he's coming from.
We
know where he's coming from because we don't know where he's coming from, right? That's the whole
He's unpredictable. That's what makes him great.
Yeah, that's okay. Ivanka will fix everything. And
oh, we didn't even talk about Ivanka.
In 2024.
Like, the best thing to come out of the G20 was that side eye she got when she wanders up and starts interjecting herself.
Yeah.
But, you know, that's everything you need to know about Ivanka Trump right there.
That was very difficult to watch. Oh, like, yeah. As you know, I don't like horror films, but I couldn't really watch that either. It was just so, like, you're sort of feeling sorry for her, but at the same time that you're like, what the hell are you doing?
She might be one of the children of the corn.
Yeah.
she's the defective
or
one.
Or actual anyway. Corn, we don't know.
Right. Moving right along, this is perhaps more serious. But last Friday, the Supreme Court of Canada ruled in a case of an Alberta rape trial that the judge in that trial allowed too much to be heard as evidence about the victim's sexual history. The victim was someone who had a friends with benefits relationship. I assume we all know what that is, or at least saw the Ashton Kutcher, Natalie Portman movie. They had a friends with benefit relationship with her, the person who allegedly assaulted her, and this was the judge allowed this to be brought up in trial. It seemed like a clear case of violating the rape shield laws, which basically say that you cannot bring up past sexual history of a complaint into a victim if it's meant to on very specific circumstances, but mm-hmm. if it's like merely meant to brought up that this person had a prior sexual relationship with their accused attacker, or that they were maybe sexually active, that's not a good enough reason to bring this up. And this is the second time the Supreme Court has done this recently.
Yeah, and something that's ongoing this week, which is the Joshua Boyle trial,
yep.
has brought this to not to light, but this change in the law has influenced this trial to a degree in terms of how far forward it's going to move. It's stalled a couple of times. It seems to have stalled again. The trials, if you don't remember the Joshua Boyle story, he and his wife went to Afghanistan. They spent years in captivity. They had some children in captivity. I think one of their kids died. Anyway, once they were released and got back to Canada, it is alleged that Boyle was assaulting his partner, Caitlin Coleman. Mm-hmm. And this is in court right now. Now, back in June, a Supreme Court judge in Ontario had said that some of the history, their past sexual history, would be allowed in this case. The case isn't about the being hostage and being taken away to Afghanistan. He's been charged and accused of sexual assault, and the third one escapes me.
Mm-hmm.
But so some of the history was allowed, and then there was this hubbub about, well, this law has changed. Well, the law hadn't changed, but the Supreme Court had said that you cannot discuss that. And all of this has actually led to Caitlin Coleman's lawyer stepping down. They might actually become a witness in the trial because he had advised her, or didn't advise her correctly, in terms of her going to the media and talking mm-hmm. about the case. Mm-hmm. So there's a heck of a lot going on in this case beyond the Supreme Court decision.
Right.
But it's obviously had a direct effect on this case, sort of ground it to a halt at least two times this week. You had mentioned that one Friends of Benefits one, then there was another one where a prostitute was killed.
Mm-hmm. And that was the one, I think, in Alberta. I think that was also involved an Ontario person, but it was in Alberta.
And the problem with that case, and this is sort of speaks to where the judges and the law system's education is on this, is that supposedly throughout the whole trial, the judge referred to the victim as the prostitute rather mm-hmm. than by her name.
Right.
And of course, when something like that happens, you're bound to color the judgment of the jury or whoever is supposed to bring down judgment. There's no question that if you say that rather than just person X, mm-hmm. because like the whole thing is like, well, she's a prostitute, so, you know, connect the dots.
Yeah.
Whereas the law states no means no.
Right.
That's the short version. It's obviously long and complicated, but it's like, if you say no, it is no. And of course, you know, nobody asks to be murdered as a product of sexual relations as well. So it's like it's almost a non-starter as to why this goes there. But
and that was in Justice Karen Kansanas' decision that no means no and only yes means yes, even in the context of an established relationship, even partway through a sexual encounter. And, you know, this is why when you're in safe space training, and the topic of consent comes up, they say, like, consent has to be constant, enthusiastic, and I forget the third thing. But yes means yes until someone says no, and then that's it. And if you keep going after that, that's technically rape. And I think one of the – to connect the dots a little to the political is that one of the things that is not going to get passed with Parliament – the House of Commons rising for the summer is the private members bill from Rona Ambrose about the more judicial training for judges on sexual violence that was passed in the House unanimously, I may add, as in all parties passed it unanimously. Mm-hmm. And then it went to this, and that was in 2017, and it basically went to the Senate to die, mostly because conservative senators were holding it up, which is kind of weird when you think it was the interim conservative leaders' own bill,
who is definitely a progressive as well. It should be mentioned that, you know, she obviously doesn't completely play by the not the old right. playbook, but let's call it the Harper playbook, because that's where she had her, you know, her day, I suppose.
Well, I mean, there were things back in the day when she was like the minister for health and being Helen Lovejoy about marijuana and everything. But I mean, this...
Yeah, no, but this is progressive
this
legislation.
This was unanimous. Everyone agreed that this is something judges needed more of, and it just died. It just like died on the table in the Senate. Mm-hmm. And I mean, the liberals have said, like, we're going to bring it back if we're reelected. But, you know, I don't understand why this is controversial in the first place. Like, Rape Shield has been part of... like Canadian law since we did the Constitution in 82. So it should be one of the least controversial things in the world. And like what this Supreme Court case, the Supreme Court docket in the last couple of months has proven is like, we need this. We need judges to understand the meaning of Rape Shield and why it's important.
And it's something to think of that they don't understand, you know, if you're a judge and, you know, if we have some inkling of how this is supposed to go, then, you know, how come it fails so miserably, so constantly? And it definitely has to change. But I think one of the places where we may see it, and I don't know if it'll set a precedent, is the Boyle trial and what comes of that. Because something else, too, as I'd mentioned, that they had children. And Caitlin Coleman is currently pregnant with their fourth child. Mm-hmm. And that, you know, you obviously can't necessarily keep that out of the record if you're in court and you're pregnant, and they'll say, well, you know, she had four children with the guy. So, but it sounds like, you know, she had, I don't want to get too much into the history, but I guess their personal history, but it's like, yeah, it's complex, right? There's nothing really simple about this. And I'm probably talking about the most complicated case that's going on right now, but, but it was, I think it was mentioned in the Star too, as we were saying about the education on this, and there needs to be, but like you say the training is out there, and I would recommend that to everybody too. It's a, because, you know, it's not just at the legal level. It's also, you know, you find it everywhere, work, here at the university, and it should happen. The education's the key, right?
Right.
So
it's, because Me Too, like, for example, there's multi-level stuff. The Me Too stuff has been largely about, like, when a woman makes an accusation about believing her and, you know, taking steps immediately. This is the other side of this, where once we get into the legal system, and I mean, and this is what a lot of, not just women, but a lot of victims of sexual assault worry about when it comes to going into the courtroom and facing a jury or facing a judge and being asked about like your most intimate sexual experiences as a way to prove you are a slut or that you are promiscuous. Even though there's laws in place that say like you cannot use that as proof unless under very particular and specific circumstances. And what it seems is that the law has been letting people down and letting women down, and that has to change. And if you're not going to listen to the Supreme Court on legal matters, who are you going to listen to? Law and Order? I don't know. Dun, dun, anyway, dun, 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 we'll have to leave that there for this week. And yeah, that is it for the show, and we hope you enjoyed it as usual. You can stay connected to us at our website, opensourcesguelph.com. Find us on Facebook at Open Sources Newswire or on Twitter at @OS_Guelph. And if you'd like to listen to our show again, you can download it from our website every Monday or on the Guelph Politicast channel on Podbean or through your favorite podcast app, whether that's iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and Spotify. You can find me on Twitter and Instagram at Adam A. Donaldson, or go to my website, guelphpolitico.ca.
Scotty Hertz on Facebook, Scotty Hertz on Twitter, and I blog on occasion at spannerbook.wordpress.com. And I promise, no robot noises from the backpack next week. I promise.
It's a pretty big promise.
I'm on quite a tech curve, you know.
Yes. We've
Even
noticed.
Though I'm the technician of the show. But anyway.
This technology hasn't changed since 1947, so we're fine. I don't know. I think we've got a rerun of DJ Sounds Good to Me. I think she's on summer vacation
now. Yes, Sounds Good to Me is on the rebroadcast. So
stay tuned for that here on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus and Community Radio. And next Thursday, we will indeed be back for more Open Sources Thursday at 5 p.m. And we will see you then.